Hey, today I'm going to be talking about the blog that I write along with Jonathan Pertle, who's seated. Jonathan, will you raise your hand? Hi, Jonathan. On public health issues. We write for the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's one hat, but as Audrey described, I'm also an academic at Drexel School of Public Health, trained primarily as a historian, but I do work in ethics and history of public health. So this is our little logo thing that Tony Auth, who's a former political cartoonist for The Inquirer, drew for us. So we began writing about a year ago, October 2011. We just passed our first anniversary. We are the only public health blog column in a major American newspaper. We post the moment 2 to 3 times a week, but as I'll describe a little later, we're about to expand to 5 days a week. We also appear periodically in the print version of the paper, and our readership has grown dramatically during our first year. During our first 3 or 4 months, we numbered in the thousands per week, and now we're between 20 and 25,000 pretty much consistently every month. How we came to be. The We in Public Health, as I said, are me and Jonathan. We were approached by the Inquirer last summer. They were interested in having a local public health authority or two start writing for them. There are some issues in this that I hope to bring up later about tensions between bloggers and journalists. That we can discuss hopefully in the question and answer session. But we basically pitched about 4 months worth of stories for them, what it would look like, and we shook on the spot to start writing a couple of weeks later. Our motto is through prevention, education, and intervention, public health practitioners, epidemiologists, health policy experts, municipal workers, environmental health scientists work to keep us healthy. It's not always easy, and we show you why. Our vision, we have a very expansive vision for what public health is and can be. So we believe that we need to engage the public on matters of public health. As I'm sure all of you are painfully aware, the public does not understand what we do. And part of what we see is to help educate the public on the diverse field that we all are involved in here in this room. We help them make sense of what public health is. We try to make the public aware of the successes, failures, and challenges of our field. And we're also a critical voice on public health. We write, exploring a variety of issues, often sometimes critically of what are some of the things that we do well and some of the things that we don't do so well. And we also believe that we are advocates for public health. We, both Jonathan and I, and as I'll tell you about in a few minutes, the folks who are starting to write for us in the coming months, really believe in what we do, as we all do in this room. We believe that our field is essential to the health of our nation and our world. I was on a panel last week at Penn State, and I was talking about the Affordable Care Act and sort of the ethical obligations we have to provide health care and the role that public health plays in that. And one of the questions I got fairly condescendingly was suggesting that I believed in unicorns and magical ponies to actually believe that we should be doing these things, to which I said, well, I actually do believe in unicorns and magical ponies, and sort of went through the litany of what believing in sort of the perhaps unimaginable or unattainable or setting lofty goals has done for us and our nation in terms of moving our health forward and the public's health forward, both through political means and through the work that we do. We write on a wide variety of issues. We engage politics. Last week we wrote about, or this is 2 weeks ago now, after Mitt Romney suggested that people don't die from lack of health insurance and should get their health care in emergency rooms. We took that issue on. We write a lot about climate change and other environmental issues. And we write about sort of everyday run-of-the-mill public health issues. We wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about the 40,000 emergency room visits over the last decade from kids swallowing button-sized batteries and what can be done to address this. Ironically, the same day we published this piece, Duracell also had a press release, having nothing to do with our piece, saying that they were changing the packaging on the button-sized batteries so kids can't get into them. Toy companies, of course, need to follow suit so kids stop, you know, playing with toys and eating these batteries. Something like 42 kids have died over the last decade. We write a lot about women's health. We write about breastfeeding. We've written about the controversy around Susan G. Komen, and we've written about the contraception debate around the Affordable Care Act. We also take on controversial issues. As Audrey said, I'm working a lot on autism right now, and there was a piece in the New York Times a couple of months ago suggesting that autism was an inflammatory disorder. While it might be, there's very little evidence at the current moment that it is. And we took on the Times and this author and got a lot of blowback, both from certain corners of the autism community and from others. We write about vaccine stuff, which always raises people's hackles. And we took on Rick Santorum last year, comparing him to Theodoric of York, the fictional Saturday Night Live character that Steve Martin portrayed in the 1970s, who was both a barber and a man of medicine. We believe we work at the nexus of scholarship and journalism. We're not journalists, but we do some journalism. We do reporting sometimes within our blogs. We interview folks. We check sources as journalists, but we're not trained as journalists. We're scholars. We write as employees of university, but we don't write for the university. And luckily, Drexel's been very supportive of us. I have tenure, so there's certain things that I can say or do that sometimes, get me in a little bit of trouble, but not a whole lot. And Drexel's been terrific. We bring the sensibility, the scholarly sensibility of the blog, but we are committed to writing for the public. And this is a challenge that a lot of academics have about translating their science to a public voice that the public can access. And that's one of our roles. One of our primary roles is reporting on interesting and exciting stuff that's going on in the field. We are, of course, rooted in the scientific literature, and rather than footnotes, we use hyperlinks galore. We hyperlink to papers that are freely available online and to PubMed for folks who want to go look and follow what we're writing about. One of the challenges, and Deb Levine, who you hear from in a few minutes, and I were just talking about, was sort of the old media meets new issue that we face, and Jonathan and I think about this a lot in the work we do and in trying to get the word out about the work we do. Now, we're really happy after a year that we have a really robust readership, but we feel like we could be doing a lot better, and part of that barrier, as Deb was describing to me, she couldn't find our Twitter handle on our site. And there's been sort of the paper has been very slow-moving in trying to figure out how to integrate social media beyond the fact that they have some bloggers working for them into their websites, and that's been a frustration of ours. So we have a strange status at the paper because we're neither traditional freelancers or employees of the paper, and of course we wear these other hats. We're edited by Don Sapakin, who's the deputy science and health editor at the paper. He's been terrific, big supporter and booster of ours. And what's sort of, I think, unique about us is that we write, and as soon as we hand something to him, it goes through the normal editing processes that any article at the paper will go through. And then he'll send stuff back to us. There's sometimes a back and forth, and then he will be the person that actually posts our material. We, of course, have free range to choose our topics, and we have never been muzzled in any way by the paper. And, of course, one of the challenges is Twitter for us and Facebook. We only have, it was actually up today after Jonathan's talk, something about 170 Twitter followers. What's strange is that, when we post something that we sort of hashtag appropriately and it gets out there, it trends pretty high pretty quickly, but we're not getting followers from that. And I think part of it is that people have trouble linking back to our Twitter account from the blog site, and this is something that we're struggling with the paper to fix. And as I said, the numbers don't seem to reflect a more significant Twitter impact. Among our followers are also local and national leaders in public health. Something else that we need to do is tweet outside of advertising what we're writing about on a particular day. Jonathan and I should be engaging more in the issues of the day, and although we retweet a lot of things that are interesting to us, we're not sort of speaking out through Twitter on, we do it occasionally, but not as much as we should be to sort of get out the word. But one of our, one of the questions that we're struggling with is, are our readers who are being funneled by the paper social media users? And I don't think so. We don't have the demographics on this. This is another challenge with the paper. We can't get good information because they don't have it set up to get that information. But we might have sort of locked in and will continue to grow the old media readership. Our challenge going ahead is nurturing that new media readership. Facebook has been virtually useless for us so far, and again, I think part of it is that linking issue. Although we have recently seen an increase in those using the platform to recommend our stories. I've said all these things. The other thing that's been sort of difficult to predict, because we blog on such diverse issues, it's been hard to predict what sort of resonates with our readership. We did two similar stories. One was a story on cup of noodles cups that tip over when they're long and narrow cups and burn kids. And there's a redesign that's been proposed by, some scientists looking at this to make it a flatter and lower cup. Pretty easy to do. And that got a lot of hits. But the battery story we did really sort of went under the radar. And to me, those are two very similar stories about sort of everyday things we can do in terms of interventions, in terms of consumer safety, but two very different outcomes. And it's been hard for us to predict how to do that. And again, I think that turning to Twitter and social media, making that a more robust sort of outreach will help fix that. Some of the challenges ahead, partner with other public health voices to promote both public health and the public's health. If you have stories that you think we might be interested in, we probably are interested in, please let us know. You can find our emails at www.philly.com/public health or come talk to me afterwards. Using social media, of course. We've thought about syndicating into other papers as a way to sort of grow our outreach around the country. Want to increase our readership, increase our Facebook and Twitter presence. We're going to be posting more. Sort of that's our next big step. Getting a sponsor. Now, what we're doing to expand our breadth and our depth is to roll out an expert panel. So as you can see here, we've got some pretty cool folks who are going to start writing with us in areas that we don't necessarily have the kind of expertise in that they do. Nan Filer, who's the chief of staff at the Health Department of Philadelphia, David Rosner, who's a historian at Columbia, Bernard Goldstein, Professor Emeritus and the former dean of Pitt School of Public Health. And you can read on just some terrific folks and some non-traditional folks in public health. We have the chief operating officer of the Philadelphia Zoo, who's going to be writing about animals, agriculture, and public health issues, sort of something that you don't see very often. Or Tia McDonald from the Vetri Foundation. For those of you from Philly, you're familiar with the Vetri restaurants, some of the best restaurants in the country, actually. Mark Vetri is a very famous chef. And they have a foundation that helps design lunch programs that are both nutritious and tasty for kids. There was some articles in the New York Times a few weeks ago, big picture of a garbage can full of school lunches with broccoli in them, what kids would eat broccoli. And Tia's going to write about how we can get kids to eat healthier foods. So that's what we do. That's who we are. I'm happy to answer questions afterwards and would stick around to talk. So thank you very much. And Megan, you're up next.